Dear future, I'm ready to remind you of your past, to draw energy and light from it, and to make you a better place in which to live.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready, a podcast brought to you from Amsterdam by Digital Society School and Transformational Studio. Your hosts for today are Carola Vashore and Marco van Hout. Together, they bring new questions for topics that are still largely unanswered, engaging with thought leaders on transformational topics that open up the conversation and the exploration of what's next as we navigate the 21st century, so that we can all say, Dear Future, I'm ready.
Orlando Wood is an advertising effectiveness expert and author of Look Out, published by the IPA earlier this year, Lemon, published in 2019, and is co-author of System One, Unlocking Profitable Growth, published in 2017. His research on advertising effectiveness draws on psychology, cultural history, and the study of the creative arts. Orlando's work describes the features of advertising that capture attention, elicit emotional response, and therefore establish lasting business effects. His work also shows how these very same features have been disappearing from advertising in the digital age. Orlando has influenced thinking and practice in research, marketing, and advertising, winning him awards from the ARF, the AMA, JGAT, ISBA, MRS, and ASMR. Orlando is a frequent conference speaker and podcast guest. Currently, he is the Chief Innovation Officer at System One Group, Honorary Fellow of the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, and a member of the IPA's Effectiveness Leadership Group. We are so delighted to have you with us, dear Orlando. Hello and welcome.
Hello and thank you, Carola. What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much. Great to be here. And hello, Marco, too. Hello. Good to be here.
Hi, Orlando, and welcome to our podcast. So as you might have read, 21 for 21 is a podcast about transformation, and we are in a time of transition. But a lot of definitions are really missing or haven't been invented yet, you might say, to describe what is really happening. And we need to rethink the way we look at society and the way we look at ourselves. And we need to, probably as you would say, look out. So we are talking to transformational leaders, 21 of them, people who are ahead of the curve and to whom we can ask what the view is like from that perspective. So to inspire us on our transformational journeys. And we hope to talk with you, Orlando, about technology, media, brands, and the transformation of advertising.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, lovely. It's fascinating. And we hope you can really tell us how you see things these days, as you are a recognized person as an authority when it comes to truly deeply understanding how humans think. You talk a lot about the brain and how we behave. So we're really excited to hear from you what your understanding is of what's going on.
What is going on?
Yeah.
Well, very good question. You know, we are, as you say, going through a period of rapid change, rapid technological change, but also cultural and societal change at the same time. And they're things that tend to go hand in hand. And, you know, my particular interest is how technology is changing culture, how it's changing business, but how it's changing advertising, but also how it's changing us in some way, because it is having an impact, I think, on the human psyche in the same way that it has done in other periods of history. And that's something that I look at in quite some detail in the latest book I've written called Look Out, as you kindly mentioned a few moments ago. And I talk about how technological disruption can shift habits of thinking. When we invent, you know, a new tool, you know, we shape our tools, but thereafter they shape us in many ways. And so, you know, like the period of around 1900, 1910, in fact, like the period of around 1500, you know, when the printing presses were invented, we are seeing similar changes in culture today. And in fact, you have to go back to the printing presses, and which were invented in the 1440s, to sort of understand some of the cultural changes we're seeing around us today. Because the printing presses, you know, they enabled the publication of the Bible, but they enabled the publication of other things too. You know, the publication of the Malleus Maleficarum, which is a guidebook for identifying and spotting witches, you know, tales of monstrous births and wondrous signs, tales of the apocalypse. You know, if you were living in around 1500, you'd have felt very disorientated, as if, you know, this was perhaps the last of days. And similarly, people felt the same after the massive industrial expansion of the late 19th century, early 20th century, too. And you get this sort of feeling that a sense of community is broken down. There's rising mental illness and anxiety. And you can trace in the art, as I do, of these two periods, changes which tell us something about the psyche of the time, of both of those periods. And I'm interested in art because art, of course, the visual arts, as well as music, play an important part in the way that we interpret the world, the way we see it. And, of course, for advertising too, the implications, I think, are clear. So what you find in these periods is that both of those periods, actually, is that humanity kind of turned inwards a little bit. That, you know, it's sort of narrowed, those technological leaps narrowed our attention. They caused us to sort of look inwards and downwards and to really sort of narrow our field of attention. And I draw on the work of a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a neuroscience researcher, a philosopher, really, called Ian McGilchrist, to try and understand what's happening, you know, at the level of the brain. And his work is fascinating because it talks about attention and the way that the two hemispheres of the brain pay attention to the world. And he talks about, well, among other things, two important concepts, I think, for us and for advertising. And that's broad beam attention and narrow beam attention. And he talks about the way in which the two hemispheres of the brain attend to the world. And it, you know, this isn't the old 1960s sort of left brain does one thing, right brain does the other. This is much more nuanced and much more explanatory. And he explains that the right brain is what presents the world to us. It has this sort of broad beam attention, you know, switched on sort of all the time. It's open to what's out there, to what's at the edge of awareness, if you like. And it passes anything of interest to the left brain for it to bring very narrow beam attention to bear on it, you know, really close up, examine it, focused attention. And what I think's been happening to us in the last 20, 10, 5 years in particular, is that we've been bringing increasingly narrow beam attention to bear on the things around us. And, you know, we're looking at our mobile devices for at least 3 hours a day, every day, you know, many cases, much more than that.
I'm fascinated by what you're telling us. I think that that explains a lot. Typically, when we ask this question within the podcast, people say, oh, my gosh, that's like the easy question first, or where is this going? And you've really come to the core of the issue, Orlando, because you've said some things that are very triggering for us. Is what we discuss in this podcast is, of course, transformation. And this concept of looking inward, looking downward, is an important human talent because it allows us to reflect. But when we are looking inwards and looking downwards, and what's in our hands is a gadget, is a piece of technology, then perhaps we're also losing contact with ourselves. And I wonder how you see that, particularly with the lens of us living in transformational times and us being social animals. How do we kind of really broaden that scope and move into the broad beam? Mm. While the world keeps spinning, right? We still have to go to our jobs and tend to our families and carry on with life as it is designed around us, which is highly technologically, for at least many people within the Western world, or highly pressured in terms of time and energy for the rest of the world. How do you see that?
Well, I think actually, if we broaden our attention, we'll do things better and do things more quickly as well. So what the narrowing of attention has done, you know, what the internet, what the digital world has done is a number of things. It's caused us to sort of look inwards and downwards. It's actually caused us to, it's sort of thinned out communication as well. So we're much more reliant on the written word than, you know, we were even 20, 30 years ago in the way that, you know, we communicate with each other. I think that's probably improved a bit over the pandemic, but, you know, email, social media are still quite word related. And that thins out all of the expression and nuance around, you know, what we're trying to say to each other, and sort of flattens things a bit. But the digital world is also, with its sort of design for the seeking and getting of reward. And that sort of triggers a kind of dopamine hit that actually prioritizes the left brain, which is more prone to aggression and anger, as well as seeing things very literally in a very linear way, and in, you know, sort of conducive to confrontation. So you get this sort of, the algorithms are sort of designed to push people to the extremes, and it hollows out the sort of center ground, and you get that kind of polarization that, you know, we're sort of seeing today that we saw in the 1920s, in fact. So there is, you know, there are certain dangers with the world. Now it's done wonderful things, you know, it's brought people together, but at the same time you have to remember that it's sort of pushed people apart too. And it's you know, enables us to do miraculous things. We couldn't have survived during the pandemic, you know, without it. Many livelihoods, and lives, you know, no doubt have been saved by technology. And it's not that I'm anti-technology at all. I'm just pro-human. And I think that there are things that we, each of us could do that perhaps, you know, a conversation with someone rather than an email, you know, that talking to people can actually speed things up rather than slow them down. And, you know, we need to remember and reconnect with the world and the people in it around us, because otherwise we will all start to feel a kind of sense of detachment. And if we, you know, detachment leads to bad places and makes society vulnerable. So yes, it's imperative that we reconnect.
Yeah, well, obviously, this is a topic that has been touched upon in big depth by Viktor Frankl on man's search for meaning, people's search for meaning. The question here then becomes one, because of course you said something implicitly about the right brain. The right brain does not have language; it doesn't have words. Mm. So to make that very explicit, as I bring in a question about this, how in a left brain dominated world, how do we reconnect with meaning and meaningfulness and our very own human nature as social animals? You gave us some tips of things we might do, but there seems to be also a huge potential for technology to support that as kind of the avenue of choice. You know, it's one thing is telling the left brain, let's not do that. But another thing is giving the left brain more leverage by really enhancing the right brain activities and the broadening of the beam. What are things that we can do within society to help that happen, to help that shift in that direction?
That's a very good question. And I think to start to answer it, you have to understand the way in which the right brain sees the world and presents it to us. And so I'll just spend a minute or two, if that's okay. So the right brain is, vigilant to what's going on around it. It's open to what's going on. It's open to novelty. It's open to, it understands the living. It understands people, the way that they connect with each other. It understands the implicit, so it understands everything that isn't said, you know, the gestures, the actions, the accents, the intonation of people around us. And it's also can see things on two levels. So it can see, it can understand that two, you know, contradictory thoughts could both be true at the same time. You know, there's a flexibility to the right brain that where the left brain is very rigid. And so it can understand metaphor, it can understand humor. It's what helps us to understand those things. It helps us to understand time. It gives us our sense of lived time, which is very important. And it gives us our sense of space as well, space and depth. It helps us to understand other people in a way that the left brain really can't. And it helps us to appreciate things like music, you know, which relies on lived time and the ability to see the whole as well as the parts. The left brain sort of can only really see the parts that, you know, decide to build things up from the parts. But the right brain sees the whole and can, you know, understand everything in its context. So that's, and that actually therefore means that, you know, the right brain is no doubt more associated with intelligence, with certain form, you know, with many forms of creativity, being able to see, put different things together to make something new, because it sees the whole. And it's also, you know, what helps us to see the difference between truths and lies, which the left brain can't really do. And it gives us, you know, our sense of, I suppose, being in this world. And so what the left brain does, it sort of tries to sort of, it takes, you know, it thinks it knows best, broadly speaking, but often it doesn't see the bigger picture. And so it creates models of the world, and it's interested in tools and various things that, you know, can help it to manipulate the world, to control the world. And so what we need to do is to find ways in which we can reconnect with the world around us and the people in it, and to appreciate some of those things which I think have sort of, certainly when you look at advertising, have disappeared a bit in the last 10 or 20 years. That sense of place, the importance of place and context, of lived time, of people connecting in dialogue, you know, the ability to see things on multiple levels, to have that flexibility of mind that perhaps the other person's right. You know, a bit of self-doubt is actually quite helpful sometimes. Because I think those are the things that, you know, will help us get to a better place, ultimately. How technology can help is a good question. I talk in the book, Look Out, about ways in which technology can be used to enhance certainly the work we create through the use of color and post-production, how we can use it to create characters, you know, that live, that seem to live and have life. Perhaps even on packaging, you know, in the connected packaging, there are certain things we can do to use technology to enhance the kind of things that the right brain loves and appreciates, and that makes us, you know, better able to connect with brands and the world around us. But it is a difficult question. I don't know whether you're getting to the metaverse, but you know, that's
not particularly.
That's another thing altogether.
But I think that the examples you've given are brilliant, and particularly to, because obviously Marco and myself are designers and we look at the world from the lens of design. And it's really about designing with, whereas I think that we have spent, all of us, society-wide, spent a lot of time designing for. And so when you change the intent, then technology becomes a means, not an end. And the example you've given of time for me is a particularly important one. So I always make a distinction, of course, between so-called Chronos and Kairos time. Chronos time being the chronological calendar-based time, the left-brained time, the time that we all feel rushed and burned out eventually for, unfortunately, many people as well. And the Kairos time is the time of experience, is the time of dreams, it's the time of fantasy, it's the time of living in the moment, which I think that technology is very well positioned to help us explore, experience in depth when we start understanding that it's about designing with. And to link to that and to your point to advertising, obviously, me being Argentinian, I look at very talented Argentinian creatives particularly in what are called the commercial arts or the advertising domain. Mm-hmm. And one person I'd like to refer to is Carlos Vallala, who is now at the new agency in London and previously at Mother and Madre, respectively, and Wyden and Kennedy. And Carlos Bajala says, when we talk about messaging, when we talk about advertising, we have to consider that there are two aspects. Of course, there is the content, but there's also the context. And the context determines to what degree the message is timely, the message is opportune, and the content determines to what degree it is relevant. And I think these are very important considerations when we utilize the beauty of technology, which is certainly there, in order to help us convey messages, because then we really are uniting the content and its relevance for impact, but particularly also the context, so that it's opportune, so that it enhances the quality of their overarching narrative, so that it helps people envision what better and possible futures are for them. And I leave it at that because I can see that Marco is jumping up and down to ask you another question.
Yes, well, I mean, I'll just say that, you know, I think you have, since the splitting up of media and advertising, you know, that perhaps that we've lost sight of that a little bit. You know, that you used to be able to, The Economist, for instance, would put on the top of buses for people in high places, you know, one of their ads on the top of buses, so only people high up could see it. So, you know, that sort of those two things together are wonderful when they work, and they should be thought of together. I absolutely agree. Sorry, Marco.
No, I think both of you make super valid points. And I think, well, being a part of digital society is cool. I cannot just but applaud everything that has been said. I think technology, and I always like to mention that it's not so much about the raw technology anymore nowadays. It should be about the integration of technology, really about, also forming this dialogue. And I liked a few things that you mentioned, you know, the connection in dialogue, the yes. creation of self-doubt in order to actually get us further. And we know that that fundamental for transformation is actually to create a vision, a shared vision. And what I also see is that it's becoming so difficult to create these proper visions when we are, I think, as you also described, detached from each other, fully inward focused. So in that sense, the technology is not helping us. And I really like how you mentioned that that we should look at the positive sides of technology to enhance actually these forces. Yeah. And
rather than brutalize the culture, you know, to enhance them. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, can we find ways in which we can, I mean, you know, just take, you know, technologies that we use to talk to each other, you know, and we have done in the pandemic, like, I don't know, not Zoom or Teams or something like that, you know, how can we create better versions of those? Not that they're not good already, but, you know, ones that enable us to perhaps make us feel less self-conscious, you know, because we're always staring at ourselves on those things. Yeah. How can we create things which are less, you know, frontally on, that sort of help us to connect in a slightly more human way?
100%. Yeah. So what do you think is needed for that to actually get us there? What would you say?
Certainly an understanding of the way that the brain, you know, sees the world. And I think, you know, articulating what's important, because, you know, really the right brain is actually, you know, everything that exists for us that has meaning really operates in time, in lived time, as Ian McGilchrist puts it. And, you know, is normally connected with the living and the places around us. You know, these are things that, this is what meaning is. This is what gives life meaning. Spontaneity, laughter, movement. These are things that the left brain's not very good at. It doesn't really understand. And you end up creating a world or finding that a world has been created by the left brain, which is rigid, which is it doesn't allow for spontaneity, that, you know, has no real understanding of place, you know, that suddenly we're in a world where, you know, these things are no longer important. And that you know, is profoundly, it's almost like a moral act, you know, as Ian McGilchrist puts it, the way we hold our attention, the way we dispose our attention, because the left brain can abolish you know, bits of the world, as he puts it. It can collapse space and time. You know, it renders the living inanimate. We've got to be careful of that and remember that it's the right brain that gives the world and gives us a sense of meaning and connection and togetherness.
That is so beautiful. That is so inspiring. Thank you, Orlando. That's very beautifully phrased. And we like to say that if you can dream it, you can do it. And I think that I've said in this podcast previously that we're in a crisis of spirituality and that we're in a crisis of imagination. And listening to this, I think that also we need one another to kind of reignite our own vitality. I think we've really gone so deeply inward, and so because it's a fear-based reaction, of course, and so looking inward and downward that we've forgotten that each one of us is a role model to every other person, and that in the way we go about our daily lives, we have a lot of significance that we can help bring into the groups that we help shape. And in design, there is a famous tool which designers like to use, which is framing challenges using "How might I?" And Marco and I, with our work we do at the Digital Society School and looking at transformation design, have rephrased that to turn the phrase into "how might I so that we." And "so that we" is about putting ourselves to the service of the society we form a part of, understanding that there is this engaging creative energy that every one of us has as part of the, as you beautifully said, as part of the gift of aliveness, that we can also give as a gift to others. So if you would have a design question you can put out there today, and you would think, "How might I so that we," what is your dream for us, for all of us? What would you like to help shape and help design?
Well, I have a few thoughts on that. I mean, one is that sometimes when you go through periods like the one I think we're in at the moment, and the one I describe in the book, periods of detachment, where there is a kind of loss of vitality and an adversarial stance, you know, you've got two options, really. You either dial down on that and make things even worse, as the left brain tends to, or you try to see the world afresh anew, and you need sometimes to look back. I know it sounds heretical today even to say to look back, but it's only by looking back sometimes that you find the energy and the life, the vitality, to push things forward in a positive way. And, you know, when you, for instance, you know, there would be no Rembrandt without Titian or Veronese. You know, I mean, you look back at these artists of the Renaissance to create the works that he did. So sometimes you have to, you know, you have to sort of find energy and light in periods that have gone before, in the energy of the music, in the energy of the film, in the, you know, the culture that's gone before, to help us to see things anew. And so, you know, I'd sort of say that, you know, how might we learn from, you know, how might I learn, how might we learn from the artists, the music, the poetry, you know, of the past? And what can that teach? That, because that can teach us as much as science and technology can, which is the lens through increasingly through which we only look today. How can we learn from those things, you know, to find ways in which we can enhance humanity with technology rather than brutalize it? That would be my sort of design question. And I think we can, by looking at one of those beautiful things that humanity's created in the past.
Absolutely, yes. And one of our first podcast guests is Wouter van Noort, who is a Dutch journalist. And in that podcast episode, we talked to him about the long now. And we also, both Marco and myself, are big fans of the work of Roman Knarsik, who is the author of a book called The Good Ancestor. So it's absolutely not heretic, especially when we looked at lived experience and lived time, to see time as a fluid thing and to see it as a cyclical thing. The sources of inspiration are everywhere because it is the gift of our ancestors to us. And when we start understanding and appreciating that from the beauty that that contains in itself as a message, as a wrapped potential that has been passed down by previous generations to us, we understand that we have that role to fulfill, and we are indebted to those that come after us in that very same way. So I love the concept of looking for sources of inspiration everywhere and letting go of the linear concept of time, because that is what, you know, the broad beam is all about, really. At least my reading of your work and why I find it so inspiring.
You're right, and thank you. I mean, there are cycles that, you know, culture goes through. I talk about them quite a bit in Lemon. You know, Ian McGilchrist talks about them, and you find, you know, there are certain periods where a certain way of thinking becomes prevalent, dominant, and that's, you know, I mean, Sir Isaiah Berlin said something similar, you know, about, you know, sometimes a subject like chemistry or physics captures the world's attention, and everything is viewed through that lens. So, you know, I think similarly we're seeing something today of that kind, you know, perhaps with technology, you know, that everything is viewed in a certain way and has to be viewed that way. And you know, that can lead to trouble. So I think I'm all for broadening our attention to, you know, bring in and draw in things, philosophy, you know, art, culture, music that can inspire, and why not?
Wonderful, wonderful. And I think those lenses, that's where I want to take you also on a journey. If we talk about the fluidity of time, when we look at the future through those lenses, I'm super curious about what your lens is if you look through that lens towards the future. And this podcast is called Dear Future, I'm Ready. So actually you look at the future through that lens and you think about the now, how you are ready for that future. So to close, Orlando, and thank you so much for such a nice conversation. Could you finish the sentence, Dear Future, I'm Ready, by telling us what you feel most ready for?
Well, let's say this, shall we? Dear future, I'm ready to remind you of your past, to draw energy and light from it, and to make you a better place in which to live.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
So amazing. Thank you so much, Orlando. That's super inspiring. On this podcast, I've said previously that I needed a tattoo, a t-shirt. I'm kind of running out of space on my body and in my home. But this one is definitely one to keep close to our hearts. Thank you so much for your inspiration.
Thanks for having me.
And igniting our own vitality so that we can engage with that future that we all dream of.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you so much.
Dear future.
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 Dear future, I'm ready.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready.
Dear future, I'm ready.